Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how we got stuck associating certain personality traits, empathy, confidence, willingness to collaborate, or tendency to be competitive with gender, and how both men's and women's work lives could be better if we moved away from these outdated assumptions. We'll spend this hour with mathematician Eugenia Cheng, who spent years in her male-dominated profession trying to embody qualities associated with masculinity until she realized this wasn't helpful to her, her students, or the quality of her research. We'll talk about how she conducts herself in professional settings today and about how she learned to help math-phobic art students love learning really complex mathematics. Our conversation starts after a short break. The standard advice for women who wanted equal opportunity to advance in fields dominated by men was act like a man, which is to say, be fiercely competitive, assume you have whatever it is necessary to get ahead, and don't waste time on collaborative efforts if they don't benefit you directly. Setting aside for a moment whether any of that is even good advice, let's get to the more obvious questions. Character traits with gender in the first place when we all know individuals who live outside those stereotypes. Associate so-called masculine traits with success because they are necessary or because for a long time men alone got to define the rules of the workplace. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a mathematician, Eugenia Cheng spent the early part of her career fighting a kind of uphill battle against sexist assumptions that men were just naturally more mathematically inclined than women. She didn't buy it, and ultimately she applied her skill with numbers to demonstrating it isn't true. And she suggests that rather than asking women to change, maybe we could change workplace culture in ways that actually benefit everybody. These days, Cheng is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and tenured in pure mathematics at the University of Sheffield and UK honorary visiting fellow at City University of London. Her new book is called X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. Eugenia, welcome back to Think.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
So you say you didn't really think a lot about your gender and how it affected your career when you were starting out, but you also recall you didn't have a lot of female role models in mathematics. Who were your role models?
My role models were all men because everyone around me was a man. And so necessarily the only role models I could find were men. And for me at the time, that was all right. But I realized it's because I was lucky enough to grow up in a family and in an education that convinced me I could do anything that a man could do. And so I didn't grow up subject to those harmful stereotypes. So I could look at male role models, as long as they had the right kinds of characters, I could look at them and believe that I could do the things that they wanted to do. And in the end, it was their characters that mattered to me more than their gender. And that was one of the things that got me thinking about this.
You think one problem with a lot of conversations about feminism is that they get mired in just defining what that term even means. How do arguments like that benefit people who prefer to keep the power balance unbalanced between women and men?
I think those arguments are often a distraction from the real point. And we're stuck in a one-dimensional gendered thinking trap, where we either think that men are inherently better than women at things, or we think that men are better than women at things because of how society has treated them, and that therefore women need to become more like men, as you said, in order to be successful. Or we think, no, women are actually better at things than men, and men should become more like women. And then that causes a backlash from men who think there's a war on masculinity, and it causes things like toxic masculinity. And then we get mired in arguments that never end, really, about how much is biology, how much is nature, and how much is nurture, and therefore what proportions we should really expect of men and women in different professions. And all of that distracts us from really doing anything about it. And it's really, I think, is an argument to try and justify inaction and maintaining the status quo in which, unfortunately, men do hold more of the power in society in general, and particularly in certain professions.
So let's apply a little simple mental math to this discussion of gender. First of all, you encourage us to think about the fact that ways we consider the cognitive differences between men and women completely fall apart at the individual level, right? Knowing somebody is male or female is not enough to predict how that person will think or what their strengths or weaknesses might be.
That's right. There are so many flaws in the arguments about men versus women that it's sometimes difficult to know where to start. But that's as good a place as any, where even if we knew that there was a broad overall difference in the distribution, so we look at the behavior of all men and the ability of all men and how that's distributed, and we compare it with all women, that doesn't tell us anything about an individual. And this is one of the problems with looking at statistics and things like averages, and even if you the variation or the standard deviation between people, it still doesn't enable us to predict anything about an individual. And that's one of the problems with thinking that a people of a gender are a monolith or that they all behave the same as each other, when in fact we would do better to respond to an actual person who's in front of us.
And just to get back to how statistics can mislead us, I think a lot of us learn median and mode in fifth or sixth grade, I can't remember. And we confuse those things and forget the limitations of them. Will you talk a little bit about the ways that they can be misused to demonstrate something that may not actually be true?
Yes. So averages are something that strikes fear in many people because of how they remember traumatic math classes when they kept being told they got it wrong. And the thing is that the world around us is complicated. And so it's understandable that we try to simplify it in order to understand it better. And one way we can do that is to take a huge set of data and reduce it to a single number that tries to capture something about that data. And averages are one way to take a whole lot of data and turn it into one number. And that's all very well. But of course, you lose a huge quantity of information by that. And whichever type of average you take, the mean, the mode, or the median, you've lost all sorts of information about how widely that data is spread and whether it's really tightly clustered in the middle, which means that everybody's the same as each other. But we all know that everybody isn't the same as each other. And so the spread within genders turns out often to be much bigger than the differences in genders. And so, in fact, guess what? Men aren't all the same. And there's a huge variation among men. And there's also a huge variation among women.
You worry that our belief in innate differences between men and women turn into an excuse that sort of gets us out of having to confront our own prejudices, that there are differences between women and men. We don't have to ask a lot about inequality of opportunity if we think, for example, that men are innately superior to women in certain fields or women are innately superior to men.
That's right. And some people, unfortunately, cling to that belief as a justification for the underrepresentation groups. And this isn't just about gender. This happens for underrepresentation along other measures as well, such as racial discrimination, socioeconomic discrimination. And the thing is that even if men and women are biologically different in some ways, and some people say, well, obviously they're biologically different in some physical ways, so there must be some difference in brain function, even aside from the massive flaw in that assumption. The thing is that that doesn't excuse our unequal treatment of people. Even if there are biological differences, I think that we're still treating people unfairly and valuing the wrong characteristics, and that even aiming for the exact same numbers in the end. And honestly, we'll never be able to tell exactly what is made from biology and what is nurture. Aside from that, we really should stop favoring the wrong people in society.
So there has been a lot of research performed to try and determine if there are brain differences between males and females, people born male and female. You remind us of some pretty specious experiments that have been used to describe kind of inherent differences between boy and girl babies. You note that baby girls were found to look at human faces slightly longer than baby boys in one study. Even if that's accurate, you say the conclusions that researchers draw, that means girls are wired for empathy and boys are wired for systematizing, that's a giant leap.
It is a giant leap. And so one of the big problems with trying to measure something biological is sure that it's really biology and not nurture and society's pressures. You sort of have to study newborn babies because the effects of society and people around the babies start to happen really as soon as a baby is born. So you have to study newborn babies. And what can you actually study that newborn babies do? Well, not very much, because they don't do very much. And so extrapolating from that to anything that adults do in their life, especially something as complex as mathematical research, is an absolutely enormous assumption. And this is a really big problem with trying to study something in a scientific controlled way, because the things that you can study in a scientific controlled way are necessarily very simple activities, whereas the behavior necessary to be a successful research scientist or research mathematician is an exceedingly complex set of behaviors that doesn't really get reflected in something simple.
All right, let's talk about your profession, mathematics. How have logical fallacies shaped the way we process the fact that more men than women find great success as mathematicians?
Well, there are, again, so many fallacies that go into this, but one is that we forget how long women have been excluded from education in the past and how much effect that might have on how we teach mathematics now and how men have been shaping the world of mathematics all the way up until really quite recently. And then there's the stereotype of what it takes to be a mathematician. And of course, if there's a stereotype that to be a mathematician, you have to be a loner, someone who likes being by themselves a lot, maybe somebody who doesn't have many friends or isn't very socially able, maybe he's someone who's a bit strange. That's often portrayed in popular media and in Hollywood movies. And so if there is a stereotype that you have to be like that to be a mathematician, then it will start to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because only people who are like that will think that they're cut out to be mathematicians. And people who aren't like that will look at the people around. I'm not like that. I'm not cut out to be a mathematician. I'll go and do something else. And that's one of the reasons I really felt that I had a responsibility to put myself forward to show that you can be a different kind of person and be a successful mathematician.
Tell us the story of Emily Noether.
Emmy Noether was a mathematician in Germany who was really at the forefront of women's participation in mathematics. She was one of the first women who was allowed to go to university. And this was, if I remember correctly off the top of my head, at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. So she was one of the first women allowed to go to university at all. Then she was one of the first women allowed to do graduate studies and get a PhD. And then she was one of the first women allowed to teach. And of course, she wasn't actually allowed to teach. It was just that she, because the male mathematicians recognized how brilliant she was, but the university administration wouldn't allow it, they had her teach under the name of somebody else, a male mathematician, and she was listed as assisting, but everybody in the know understood that she was actually going to be the one giving the lectures. And of course, she couldn't be paid because of course women couldn't be paid to teach. And it actually Einstein was one of the people who intervened to try and persuade the university that women should be allowed to hold university positions, and in particular that Emmy Noether was very, very deserving. And some of the people were horrified and thought that people didn't fight in the war in order to learn at the feet of women. And so she was eventually, it's a sad story. This story does not have a happy ending. She was eventually granted permission to have the lowliest possible teaching position. And then, unfortunately, she was Jewish, and the Nazis decided that Jewish people were not allowed to hold civil service positions, and university positions were civil service positions, so she was not allowed to have that anymore. So she actually came to America as a refugee, and because at the time there was an appreciation that oppressed intellectuals from Europe were of great value to society. And so she had a position at Bryn Mawr in the US, and then unfortunately she died quite young of a tumor after all of that. And so she had these repeated struggles that were first of all because of being a woman, and then because of being Jewish, and then health issues. But I haven't even said anything about her work. Her mathematics is one of the great founding theories of modern pure mathematics. But it's often, I think it's a little undervalued, and this is perhaps just my opinion. But the thing is that it's not a huge long-standing solution It's an illumination of theory, and that is something I don't think we value enough.
My guest is mathematician and author Eugenia Chang. We're talking about her new book, X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with mathematician and author Eugenia Chang. She is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and tenured professor in pure mathematics at the University of Sheffield, also UK honorary visiting fellow at City University of London. Her new book is called X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. All right, there will be some math in the rest of this conversation, but no one needs so much as scratch paper to follow along. Remind us, Eugenia, of the null hypothesis, what that means.
The null hypothesis is an important part of the scientific framework where you decide what your basic assumption is going to be that you will default to in the absence of evidence of something else. And so when you're trying to prove something using the scientific method, you say, well, can I find evidence that this other thing is happening? And if you don't find any evidence, you revert back to your null hypothesis.
So if I'm trying to understand gender inequality, I have a choice, right? My null hypothesis can be that there is no unfairness, or my null hypothesis can be that there is unfairness. How might it tip my argument, my results in one direction or the other, just starting off with a different hypothesis that appears to describe essentially the same thing?
I think it really tips it dramatically because it's so difficult to prove anything in particular about inequality. And just as most, I would dare to say all women, no, I'll say most women to be safe. Most women feel that they've experienced discrimination for being a woman, but how can you ever prove it? You can't actually prove, because no one sits down and admits, yes, I definitely discriminated against you because you're a woman. But you start to feel a certain pattern of things going on around you. Maybe you get overlooked for a number of jobs, even though you're very well qualified, or you get overlooked for promotions, or other people are treated with more respect. One thing that often happens to me is that in meetings, other people get to speak a lot more than I do. And you can't ever prove that those things really are discrimination on the basis of your gender. And so if you can't ever really prove anything, then you'll always end up defaulting back to the null hypothesis. And in that case, it really matters which one you picked as your null hypothesis. And it turns out that your bias, your beliefs about what's happening in the system get embedded into the theory that you come up with.
So you also challenge us to consider why we rely so heavily on gendered words to describe one another's traits. Why do we characterize certain behaviors, certain ways of being as masculine or feminine to begin with?
It's very deeply rooted in society, and it's hard to say why we do it. And so I do focus more on the book on what we could do instead. But from what I've read and what I've seen, it simply comes from society having been dominated by men for such a long time, and that domination being perpetuated by needing to keep women in some kind of place of subservience or fulfilling roles in life that aren't so much associated with achievement in the outside world, earning money, owning property, things like that. And so I think that's where it comes from. And because we've all grown up with this idea of masculinity and femininity, it can be very hard to escape it until, first of all, you notice that it's going on, and then you decide that you want to escape that trap. And then crucially, I've come up with some words to help us escape that trap.
My guest this hour is mathematician Eugenia Chang. She is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. All right, Eugenia, until recently, at least, certain traits seen as masculine have been highlighted as factors in career success, a certain kind of aggressiveness and competitiveness. How were women encouraged to act like men in order to gain success?
Well, like you said earlier on, that has been a typical kind of advice given to women at things like events where women are panelists, and I've taken part in plenty of them myself, where there's a panel of successful women giving advice to younger women about how to be successful. And I've often had the experience where everyone else on the panel will say, oh, you have to be more confident in your own abilities, and you have to stand up for yourself, put yourself forward, take risks. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that if you can do those things, then maybe that will help you be successful. But unfortunately, it has the effect of putting off some women who think, oh, I don't want to, I don't like taking risks. I don't like being out of my comfort zone. I guess that means I can't be successful then. And I like to say, actually, I'm not a risk taker, and I don't ever step out of my comfort zone. And yet I am a very successful woman. And moreover, I think that our emphasis on those kinds of aggressive, risk-taking, competitive behaviors are only beneficial for success because the system is kind of rigged to favor those traits, even though I don't think they're necessarily beneficial for us in society.
Something you write in this book will really stick with me, which is that, as you said, you don't like to step outside your comfort zone. What you focus on is expanding your comfort zone.
That's right. And to me, that's a more productive way of proceeding, because I think my comfort zone is there for a reason, and that just like I don't want to make myself uncomfortable while I'm doing exercise because I might injure myself. And actually, a good comfort zone is there to protect us, that I don't want to go somewhere dangerous because something bad might happen to me. And so instead, I try and understand what my comfort zone is there for and then try to expand it, but not by just arbitrarily stepping outside it and taking risks. And this is related to what I do instead of taking risks, which is that I build a safety net around me so that it isn't a risk anymore. It's like wearing a seatbelt, really, that I feel safer and better, and then I can achieve more knowing that I have that safety net.
How often are men encouraged to act more like women to further their careers?
I think that there is some more progressive writing at the moment that is observing that something like, oh, women's leadership styles make for more productive teams and that men should learn these women's leadership styles. And the trouble with that is that it's still stuck in that gendered thinking. And whenever we say that men should be like women or women should be like men or that men should learn feminine traits or women should become more masculine, it sounds like something is wrong because we're doing something that sounds like it's against our nature. And this can inherently build in obstacles, psychological obstacles, because it sounds like we're going against something about ourselves, which is why I have proposed new terminology so that we can stop associating those things with gender.
So let's talk about that. Tell us about the terms congressive and ingressive and what they mean.
Yes, I came up with these words because I thought we just need new words so that we can escape associating character traits with gender. And so I thought about it really hard and I came up with these words. Ingressive is supposed to signify going into things and not so much worrying about people around you or the community. And it's about being very individualistic in your thinking. And congressive is about bringing people together, bringing things together, thinking about context and the community and thinking of the community as a whole and how we are all part of a community. And I think that ingressive behavior is what has been favored in society for a really long time, even though congressive behavior is, I believe, better for society.
So a lot of people might think that math requires ingressive traits, as you've described them. How does congressive behavior function in mathematics?
Well, mathematics these days is exceedingly collaborative. And maybe at some point in the past, when communication across different countries was harder, it did take more of just individuals in isolation plowing through problems. And the thing is that that has been very much romanticized by the stories of mathematicians who work by themselves in a corner for 10 years and then emerge, perhaps very disheveled, having solved a long-standing problem that people have been thinking about for 100 years. And that's more dramatic, whereas the story of people collaborating a lot for a while and gradually making progress and sharing their ideas is perhaps not as exciting, but it's more realistic and productive about to do with how math is actually done now. And a lot of math is not about solving some great problem that was posed 100 years ago. And I think the idea of solving a long-standing problem is very ingressive. It's the idea of getting a right answer. And unfortunately, we portray math very ingressively through most of standard education. So in math class, many people start getting put off when it turns into being all about getting the right answer. And so when you're very little, say in kindergarten and first grade, you play around with ideas and try to understand what numbers are. And then suddenly it turns into, okay, do this arithmetic. No, you got the wrong answer. How many points did you get? How many questions can you do in a minute? Whereas research is much more like kindergarten, actually. It's about playing around with ideas and seeing how we can understand it and talking to each other and sharing those ideas. So we teach math ingressively, and we filter ingressively using ridiculous exams and pointless standardized tests. And then we try and use that to filter people into research, which is, in fact, very congressive. So I think we're doing it really the wrong way round.
So it sort of leaves out the creativity of math.
Yes, and that makes me really sad, because so many people tell me that the reason they were put off math is because they're a creative person. And so they were drawn to things like art or creative writing or poetry or music, because those are creative subjects. And sometimes I see articles in the press, I'm afraid, saying things like, oh, the future is going to be all run by robots. And so the reason that humans are going to have value is for our creativity. And therefore, we shouldn't focus on STEM subjects. We should focus on the arts, because that's where creativity is. And so I sort of agree with it all the way up until that last part, where there's an assumption that arts have creativity and sciences and math and STEM subjects don't. And that's an unfortunate relic of how we've been presenting those subjects in school for too long.
People may know this about you. You're also a musician. How much has math informed the way you play the piano?
It has informed the way I play the piano a lot, actually. And just like questions about gender, I've been asked questions about the relationship between math and music for a really long time. And as with gender, I used to resist thinking about it. I didn't want to think about that for some reason. And I think people often say to me things like, oh, well, there's counting in math and there's also counting in music. And I think to myself, well, that's the most boring part of math and the most boring part of music put together. Whereas for me, math is not just about numbers and equations. For me, math is about structures, how things work and why they fit together the way they do. And the music that I love the most is also about structure. It's not just about a pretty melody. It's about structures of how things fit together, either broadly across entire pieces, because I play classical music, and sometimes those pieces are really huge. And if someone sits down to write a piece that lasts an hour, they don't just start at the beginning, write notes for an hour, and then finish. There's a broad structure, and there's symmetry in that structure and relationships between different parts of the music. And that, to me, is how mathematics helps me understand really huge pieces of music. And it's also how mathematics helps me understand the world around me, because it's about seeing relationships between different situations and fitting pieces together so that we can understand giant amounts of stuff using our really tiny brains.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Another interesting similarity between those two things is that if you want to really get to the place where you can find great joy in making music or in doing math, you have to get a fair amount of learning under your belt and do a fair amount of practice. It can be sort of a drag. I remember teaching my kids how to read, and it's not so much fun to learn letters and sounds until you can put words together and make a story. I would imagine the same is true to get to the joyful moment of math. You do have to sort of put in some effort doing things that just have to be learned.
That is true to a certain extent, but it's not as true as we make it out to be in the education system. Because I think that the really creative part of math, typically you don't get to see unless you start doing a PhD. And that's absurd, because we go through years and years of tests before we see that part. It would be like not being allowed to eat food until you have passed years and years of exams in cooking, or not being allowed to listen to music until you've passed years and years of music exams. And I think that with reading, we do start giving children stories to read, even when they don't know very many words. You can have stories with not very many words, and you can see the stories in mathematics without being able to do all the technical details and without being able to necessarily produce those stories yourself. Just like many people read books, and I'm happy that many people do still read books, even though they don't write their own books. And somehow we think about reading, writing, and arithmetic as basic skills, and we separate reading and writing into two parts, the part where you produce it for yourself and the part where you take in what other people have produced. But we don't do that with math. And I think that we should, that there is a lot of benefit to being able to appreciate and play around with and sort of see math that other people have done, even if you're not doing groundbreaking research yourself.
So a number of years ago, you got this cool gig as scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And a number of the students that you would teach define themselves as artists. You note that some of them conceive of themselves as math phobic. So you had to think creatively about how you could just get your students on board with you for the semester. What kinds of ideas did you work through to find the way you teach now?
It was really my dream job when I saw this possibility. And I loved the opportunity to turn people's minds around about their attitude towards math. And I know that many people have had terrible experiences of math in school. And I'd like to stress that I'm not blaming teachers for that. The teachers' hands are tied by a system that insists on standardized tests and that evaluates teachers according to standardized tests. And so all that happens is that you get trained up for a standardized test. Fortunately, at the School of the Art Institute, we do not have anything like a standardized test. We don't even have grades. The whole school has no grades, which I think is wonderful. It means that I'm really free to explore and to allow students to explore in ways that they've never been allowed to explore before in math. And for me, the exploration and making things up is part of what the joy is. And no, actually, you don't have to have a lot of technical facility in order to do that. As long as someone comes up with exploration projects that don't require you already to be able to do something like solve a quadratic equation. And there are plenty of those things, because actually, even the research I do doesn't really use any school mathematics. It doesn't use numbers. It doesn't use equations. It never uses any arithmetic. I don't have to multiply anything. Many of my students can't do their multiplication tables. And that's fine, because math is about relationships and structures. And so I focus on that aspect with the students. And most importantly, I think about what motivates them. Because to teach well, it's no good if you just take your own motivation and impose it on other people's heads. And unfortunately, I think that happens too often. It's important to understand what motivates the students and tap into that.
My guest is mathematician and author Eugenia Chang. She is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and author of a new book called X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is mathematician Eugenia Chang. She is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. We're talking today about her new book, X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. All right, to the phones now, we have David in Keller, Texas. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's
Sure. Fascinating.
So I have a question. I am a father of three girls, the oldest of whom is nine. She is very creative, loves to draw, loves to read. She is good at math, but doesn't think she is, and she wants to be a scientist. So any advice on how we can get her over that belief that she's not good at math and that she can be scientific, mathematical, and creative all at the same time?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for that question. And honestly, that's something I hear a lot. And I think it's a very congressive character trait, actually, thinking you're not good at something, whereas an ingressive character trait is overestimating your own abilities. And this is where it helps to have ungendered terminology, because I used to say that it was typically male students who overestimated their abilities. And then you have to quickly say, oh, but not all male students do that, because you start offending people. So now I can simply say ingressive students overestimate their abilities. And actually, that is detrimental to their mathematics, because it means that they assume they're right, they don't check their answers, and they leap forward without really understanding things. Whereas congressive students are worried about whether they're good enough. And so they if they're not too put off by that worry. They check their answers really hard. And it's often because they're seeking a deeper understanding than the people who think they've understood but haven't really. And if you're surrounded by those kinds of ingressive students who boast about how great they are and how easy they find it, yes, you can feel that you're not good enough. And what I always want to say to those people is that the truly great mathematicians I know, we all think that we're kind of stupid and that we don't understand anything. And it's not because we don't understand things. It's because we're seeking a deeper level of understanding. And that makes us better mathematicians. So actually, I would much rather have students who think they're no good at things and work with people who underestimate their abilities. We all know people who think they're really great when they're not. And as a result, their work is not really fantastic. And I think that's one of the ways in which we reward ingressive behavior, even though it's not really good for society.
I want to talk about Florence Nightingale here because your book really helped me understand that the way we understand her has very much been framed by the way we characterized sort of the ideal role. If a woman were to work outside the home, we think a nurse is terrific. You know, they're caring and empathetic. You remind us that Florence Nightingale was a groundbreaking mathematician who incorporated data into her work all the time.
Yes, and I sometimes like to think that Florence Nightingale is the most famous woman mathematician. It's just that most people don't realize that they know, that they've heard of a woman mathematician. And that her great insight, yes, she was a nurse, but her great contribution and insight was to use data very carefully to understand what was causing high mortality rates. And then moreover, she understood how to present data. She used graphs to depict data in such a way that her message about that data would get across. And that was how she was able to dramatically improve the mortality rates at the time.
So what kinds of things was she studying and looking at? You know, mortality rates, was she comparing that with the amount of water patients were given? Or what sorts of data was she calculating?
I believe it was to do with hygiene. And off the top of my head, I can't remember the exact details, but I think it was to do with hygiene and the seasons. And so she had things that were a bit like pie charts, but they weren't round circles. They were sort of spirals showing how many deaths there were at different times of year going round in a circle, showing that it really mattered about the seasons and that was something to do with the levels of hygiene. Because at the time, I think they hadn't made a strong connection between the hygiene and the death rates.
To go back to the ideas of congressive and ingressive qualities again, we tend to believe very strongly that there are motivational benefits to competition, which is probably the most ingressive sort of form of motivation there can be. What are the potential hazards of competition from the perspective of doing good science?
Well, often it means that people are so focused on doing something first that they're not focused on doing it well. And unfortunately, it can also lead to really bad behavior, like the fabrication of data and things like very selective data, throwing away data that doesn't look good enough, and just making things up and seeing things that aren't there because you're so desperate to get somewhere first. And some people say, oh, but competition has caused great results to happen. And it's true, it has, but we don't really know what would have happened if everyone had collaborated instead of trying to beat each other to the punchline. And in my field of research, mathematics, we really don't compete with each other to do things first. It's a kind of polite, I don't know, it's very congressive field, where if we think that we have an idea about something someone else is working on, we'll work together with them on it. We won't just secretly try and beat them to it. And I just think that's a much more productive way to proceed, that we can do a lot more if we work together than if we work against each other. Not to mention the fact that competition is fun for people who like competition, but it's not fun for people who don't like competition. And I'm somebody who really hates competition, and that I freeze up and I don't like the fact that someone is trying to beat me. And I do much better if I think that we're all striving together towards the same goal of making the world a better place.
It's obvious that everyone needs to sort of understand how to, you know, process their money when they do a transaction. They need to understand a mortgage and their own paychecks and personal budgeting. And there are many other ways where we use math every single day of our lives. It's hard sometimes for students to relate the math they use in everyday life to the kind of math that they're taught, particularly in high school and at the university level. Are we teaching the right kinds of math? Is the argument that teaching sort of very high-level math to everyone is really about helping people develop good thinking skills?
I think that math should be taught more about teaching good thinking skills. And the kind of math you mentioned about finances and budgets and mortgages is more about direct applications, and it's more to do with arithmetic than about thinking. And I think that there are really three reasons to teach math. The one is those things, the practical applications in your daily life. And then there's another one, which is, yes, if you're going to be a scientist or an engineer or something like that, you do need specific mathematical skills in order to proceed. But there's something really important about mathematical thinking. And that's the thing I think we're missing in math education, because the world around us has changed since education started. Back in the old days, the problem was the access to information in the world. We just had to get information into our brains. And now we have the opposite problem. There is too much information in the world. And what's a really important skill now is the ability to decide what counts as good information and what doesn't. And I think this is a really big problem in the world at the moment, which is why people don't believe in science and that they latch on to conspiracy theories that have no basis. There is a reason for that. And I think that every academic discipline comes with a framework for deciding clearly what counts as good information. And that's what I think we would do better to focus on. And mathematics is part of that, that if we teach math in a way that puts people off, then we end up with people, adults in the world, who are averse to mathematics and data. And that's a very bad situation for us to be in. And it means that you can be manipulated by unscrupulous people who want to use data and numbers and arguments to change how you think. Whereas if you yourself can think through a problem, whether it's about numbers or just a logical argument, if you can think through it for yourself, you don't have to just believe somebody and believe in the authority of somebody and pick an authority figure to believe in. It means that you can decide for yourself what counts as good information. And that's what I teach to my art students. It's about how to think clearly through the very difficult and nuanced arguments about life around us. And math is a good place to practice that.
These days, we're using computers to process big data, and sometimes they provide us with information that appears significant, but we have no idea why. How can we use mathematical thinking to process that information that may come to us with very little context, but be accurate in terms of, insofar as the numbers are accurate?
I think if we don't have access to how things were done, then it's hard for us to check it for ourselves, but we can at least dig into how it's being portrayed and try and understand where it did come from. And things happen such as inequality can be embedded sometimes into the processes that are used. If it's, say, an algorithm that's being used to determine something like prison sentences or whether people should be given parole or not, if it has been based on previous decisions made by humans, that's always a sure sign that the prejudices of humans will be embedded into that algorithm. And so even though we might not have access to the data that was used and we don't have access to the program that made the algorithm, we can understand the general principle that if it was based on human behavior, then it will reflect the biases of human behavior. And that way of being able to focus on a particular aspect of a situation and what led to what in a situation while temporarily ignoring some of the details, that's a really important skill that math teaches us. It's the process of abstraction, where we look deeply into a situation, temporarily ignore some surface details, and try and figure out some essential heart of what's making that situation happen.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones now. We have David calling us from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, honey. Yeah, your guest is dead on right. I ran into a book some years ago called Our Stolen Future, and it had to do with the way that the world is becoming more complicated, the more that we need to have people with engineering skills and data processing skills and all sorts of different needs for a complicated world, and that ADD, attention deficit disorder, was occurring in a new generation, and that whether or not the complicated world could be could survive with so many people coming up with ADD. And the other thing I was just going to raise, I'm baby boom, and when I think of the different ways that Americans have been cheated, at least five different times in the baby boom, the savings and loans crooks, the subprime, the BCCI, the Solomon Brothers scandals, where the value of the money has been shifted overnight and that the average person didn't realize how much things had changed. So as baby boom, it took me 20 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold. Now today, I see the price is $19.09, and if you divide that by 20, you're going to find, I'm going to guess it's about a $93 an hour minimum wage. Hmm. And it takes you 270 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold.
All right, David, you've put a lot on the table with 2 minutes left in the show. But Eugenia, do you have responses to all that? Thanks for calling.
Briefly, thank you very much. I'd like to say, yes, we need to be able to understand everyone. It would help if everyone understood the details of how financial mathematics works. But if we try and push that down the throats of people in school, and we don't focus on whether they're actually enjoying it or not, then we won't have achieved anything. Because if we try to teach people things and they hate it, then it's just as if we did nothing. And actually, it's worse, because as soon as they finish, and my art students sometimes tell me this, as soon as they don't have to do it anymore, they'll run as fast as possible in the opposite direction. And so I think it's important that we focus first on making sure that people don't have a phobia and a fear of mathematics, so that we can have people in the world, adults in the world, who can participate in a democratic society with full awareness of how to build good arguments and how to really test whether people are manipulating you or showing you good arguments based on logic and evidence and a framework rather than wild assumptions.
What would a more congressive society and workplace culture look like?
I think a more congressive society and workplace would be inclusive. It's about general inclusivity of people rather than the ingressive way of trying to keep people out. It's about looking for ways to bring people in rather than to keep them out, and to think about all the ways in which people can contribute, and to provide a nurturing congressive environment so that congressive people can thrive. Ingressive people thrive better, but only in an ingressive environment. And I think that we are losing out and we are unfairly excluding congressive people from the world to the detriment of our world. And I think that if we can create more nurturing environments and supportive environments, then nobody will need to have amazing self-confidence or the ability to take risks, because we can support each other instead of requiring everyone to think of themselves as an individual supporting themselves. And that is my dream of a congressive utopia that I think will be better for everyone of all genders.
Mathematician, professor, and author Eugenia Chang is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and she was tenured in pure mathematics at the University of Sheffield. Her new book is called X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. Eugenia, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or catch up on what you missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.